This book contains up to 4 sides per cassette. Side 1, The Transmigration of Timothy Archer by Philip K. Dick. Copyright 1982 by Estate of Philip K. Dick. All rights reserved. Narrated by James D. Lotell. This book contains 255 pages on 6 sides. If you would like to skip over any remaining announcements or introductory material, place your cassette player in fast forward until a beep is heard. Stop at that point to hear the beginning of the book. Annotation. Episcopalian Bishop Timothy Archer's life changes dramatically when his son's suicide begins a series of deaths. Supernatural messages from loved ones warn the bishop and his daughter-in-law of each impending death and help them cope with their grief. Final volume of Valis Trilogy, inspired by a mystical event the author experienced. Sequel to The Divine Invasion, RC 35691. Strong Language, 1982. From the book jacket. Although known during his lifetime as a writer of science fiction, and more recently as the inspiration for such films as Blade Runner and Total Recall, Philip K. Dick properly belongs in the tradition of Vonnegut, Calvino, and Robertson Davies. His novels place touchingly ordinary men and women in intimate congress with the unknowable and the awful. The Transmigration of Timothy Archer, the final novel in the trilogy that also includes Valis and The Divine Invasion, is an anguished, learned, and very moving investigation of the paradoxes of belief. It is the story of Timothy Archer, an urbane Episcopal bishop haunted by the suicides of his son and mistress, and driven by them into a bizarre quest for the identity of Christ. About the author. Philip K. Dick was born in Chicago in 1928 and lived most of his life in California. He briefly attended the University of California, but dropped out before completing any classes. In 1952, he began writing professionally and proceeded to write 36 novels and 5 short story collections. He won the Hugo Award for Best Novel in 1962 for The Man in the High Castle and the John W. Campbell Memorial Award for Best Novel of the Year in 1974 for Flow My Tears, The Policeman Said. The Valis Trilogy was inspired by a mystical experience that Dick had in March of 1974 and described as an invasion of my mind by a transcendentally rational mind. Philip K. Dick died of heart failure following a stroke on March 2, 1982, in Santa Ana, California. An ode for him. Ah, Ben, say how or when shall we thy guests meet at those lyric feasts, made at the sun, the dog, the triple ton, where we such clusters had as made us nobly wild, not mad. And yet each verse of thine outdid the meat, outdid the frolic wine. My Ben, or come again, or send to us thy wit's great overplus, but teach us yet wisely to husband it, lest we that talent spend, and having once brought to an end that precious stock, the store of such a wit the world should have no more. Robert Herrick, 1648. 1. Barefoot conducts his seminars on his houseboat in Sausalito. It costs $100 to find out why we are on this earth. You also get a sandwich, but I wasn't hungry that day. John Lennon had just been killed, and I think I know why we are on this earth. It's to find out that what you love the most will be taken away from you, probably due to an error in high places rather than by design. After I parked my Honda Civic in the metered slot, I sat listening to the radio. Already all the Beatles songs ever written could be heard on every frequency. Shit, I thought. I feel like I'm back in the 60s, still married to Jefferson Archer. Where's Gate 5? I asked 2 hippies going by. They didn't answer. I wondered if they'd heard the news about John Lennon. I wondered then what the hell I cared about Arabic mysticism, about the Sufis and all that other stuff that Edgar Barefoot talked about on his weekly radio program on KPFA in Berkeley. The Sufis are a happy lot. They teach that the essence of God isn't power or wisdom or love, but beauty. That's a totally new idea in the world, unknown to Jews and Christians. I am neither. I still work at the Musique Shop on Telegraph Avenue in Berkeley, and I'm trying to make the payments on the house that Jeff and I bought when we were married. I got the house, and Jeff got nothing. That was the story of his life. Why would anybody in their right mind care about Arabic mysticism? I asked myself as I locked up my Honda and started toward the line of boats. Especially on a nice day. But what the fuck? I had already made the drive over the Richardson Bridge, through Richmond, which is tawdry, and then past the refineries. The bay is beautiful. The police clock you on the Richardson Bridge. They time when you pay your toll, and when you leave the bridge on the Marin side. If you arrive in Marin County too soon, it costs you big bucks. I never cared for the Beatles. Jeff brought home Rubber Soul, and I told him it was insipid. Our marriage was breaking up, and I dated from hearing Michel one big in time, day after day. That would be roughly around 1966, I guess. A lot of people in the Bay Area date events by the release of Beatles records. Paul McCartney's first solo album came out the year before Jeff and I separated. If I hear Teddy Boy, I start crying. That was the year I lived in our house alone. Don't do it. Don't live alone. Right up to the end, Jeff had his anti-war activity to keep him company. I withdrew and listened to KPFA playing Baroque music better left forgotten. That was how I first heard Edgar Barefoot, who impressed me initially as a jerk-off, with his little voice and that tone of savoring his own cerebral activity immensely, delighting like a two-year-old in each successive satori. There is evidence that I was the only person in the Bay Area who felt that way. I changed my mind later. KPFA started broadcasting Barefoot's taped lectures late at night, and I would listen while I tried to get to sleep. When you're half asleep, all that monotonous intoning makes sense. Several people explained to me once that subliminal messages had been inserted in all the programs aired in the Bay Area around 1973, almost certainly by Martians. The message I got from listening to Barefoot seemed to be, "You are actually a good person, and you shouldn't let anyone else determine your life." Anyhow, I got to sleep more and more readily as time passed. I forgot Jeff and the light that had gone out when he died, except that now and then an incident would pop into existence in my mind, usually regarding some crisis in the co-op on University Avenue. Jeff used to get into fights in the co-op. I thought it was funny. So now, I realized as I walked up the gangplank onto Edgar Barefoot's cushy houseboat, I will date my going to this seminar by John Lennon's murder. The two events are for me of a seamless whole. What a way to start understanding, I thought. Go back home and smoke a number. Forget the wimpy voice of enlightenment. This is a time of guns. You can do nothing, enlightened or otherwise. You are a record clerk with a degree in liberal arts from Cal. The best lack all conviction, something like that. What rough beast slouches towards Bethlehem to be born? A creature with bad posture, nightmare of the world. We had a test on Yeats. I got an A-. I was good. I used to be able to sit on the floor all day eating cheese and drinking goat's milk, figuring out the longest novel. I have read all the long novels. I graduated from Cal. I live in Berkeley. I read The Remembrance of Things Past, and I remember nothing. I came out the door I went in, as the saying goes. It did me no good, all those years in the library, waiting for my number to light up, signifying that my book had been carried to the desk. That's true for a lot of people, most likely. But those remain in my mind as good years in which we had more cunning than is generally recognized. We knew exactly what we had to do. The Nixon regime had to go. We did what we did deliberately, and none of us regrets it. Jeff Archer is dead now. John Lennon is dead as of today. Other dead people lie along the path, as if something fairly large passed by. Maybe the Sufis, with their conviction about God's innate beauty, can make me happy. Maybe this is why I am marching up the gangplank to this plush houseboat. A plan is fulfilled in which all the sad deaths add up to something instead of nothing. somehow get converted to joy. A terribly thin kid who resembled our friend Joe the Junkie stopped me, saying, "Ticket? You mean this thing?" From my purse I got out the printed card that Barefoot had mailed me upon receipt of my $100. In California, you buy enlightenment the way you buy peas at the supermarket, by size and by weight. "I'd like 4 pounds of enlightenment," I said to myself. "No, better make that 10 pounds. I'm really running short." "Go to the rear of the boat," the skinny youth said. "And you have a nice day," I said. When one catches sight of Edgar Barefoot for the first time, one says he fixes car transmissions. He stands about 5'6", and because he weighs so much, you get the impression that he survives on junk food, by and large hamburgers. He is bald. For this area of the world, at this time in human civilization, he dresses all wrong. He wears a long wool coat and the most ordinary brown pants and blue cotton shirt, but his shoes appear to be expensive. I don't know if you can call that thing around his neck a tie. They tried to hang him, perhaps, and he proved too heavy. He broke the rope and continued on about his business. Enlightenment and survival are intermingled, I said to myself as I took a seat. Cheap folding chairs, and already a few people here and there, mostly young. My husband is dead, and his father is dead. His father's mistress ate a mason jar of barbiturates and is in the grave, perpetually asleep, which was the whole point of doing it. It sounds like a chess game. The bishop is dead, and with him the blonde Norwegian woman who he supported by means of the bishop's discretionary fund, according to Jeff. A chess game and a racket. These are strange times now, but those were far stranger. Edgar Barefoot, standing before us, motioned us to change seats, to sit up front. I wondered what would happen if I lit a cigarette. I once lit a cigarette in an ashram, after a lecture on the Vedas. Mass loathing descended on me, plus a sharp dig in the ribs. I had outraged the lofty. The strange thing about the lofty is that they die just like the common. Bishop Timothy Archer owned a whole lot of loftiness, by weight and by size, and it did him no good. He lies like the rest, underground. So much for spiritual things. So much for aspirations. He sought Jesus. Moreover, he sought what lies behind Jesus, the real truth. Had he been content with the phony, he would still be alive. That is something to ponder. Lesser people, accepting falsehood, are alive to tell about it. They did not perish in the Dead Sea Desert. The most famous bishop of modern times bit the big one because he mistrusted Jesus. There is a lesson there. So perhaps I have enlightenment. I know not to doubt. I know also to take more than 2 bottles of Coca-Cola with me when I drive out into the wastelands, 10,000 miles from home, using a gas station map as if I am still in downtown San Francisco. It's fine for locating Portsmouth Square, but not so fine for locating the genuine source of Christianity, hidden from the world these 2,200 years. I will go home and smoke a number, I said to myself. This is a waste of time. From the moment John Lennon died, everything has been a waste of time, including mourning over it. I have given up mourning for Lent. That is, I cease to grieve. Raising his hands to us, Barefoot began to talk. I little noted what he said, neither did I long remember, as the expression goes. The horse's ass was me, for paying $100 to listen to this. The man before us was the smart one, because he got to keep the money. We got to give it. That is how you calculate wisdom, by who pays. I teach this. I should instruct the Sufis, and the Christians as well, especially the Episcopalian bishops with their funds. Front me $100, Tim. Imagine calling the bishop Tim. Like calling the Pope George or Bill, like the lizard in Alice. I think Bill descended the chimney, as I recall. It is an obscure reference. Like what Barefoot is saying, it is little noted, and no one remembers it. Death in life, Barefoot said, and life in death. 2 modalities, like yin and yang, of one underlying continuum. 2 faces. A holon, as Arthur Koestler terms it. You should read Janus. Each passes into the other as a joyous dance. It is Lord Krishna who dances in us and through us. We are all Sri Krishna, who, if you remember, comes in the form of time. That is his real universal shape. Ultimate form, destroyer of all people, of everything that is. He smiled at us all with beatific pleasure. Only in the Bay Area, I thought, would this nonsense be tolerated. A 2-year-old addresses us. Christ, how foolish it all is. I feel my old distaste, the angry aversion we cultivate in Berkeley that Jeff enjoyed so. His pleasure was to get angry at every trifle. Mine is to endure nonsense, at financial cost. I am terribly frightened of death, I thought. Death has destroyed me. It isn't Sri Krishna, destroyer of all people. It is death, destroyer of my friends. It singled them out and left everyone else undisturbed. Fucking death, I thought. You homed in on those I love. You utilized their folly and prevailed. You took advantage of foolish people, which is truly unkind. Emily Dickinson was full of shit when she prattled about kindly death. That's an abominable thought. That death is kind. She never saw a 6-car pile-up on the East Shore Freeway. Art, like theology, a packaged fraud. Downstairs, the people are fighting while I look for God in a reference book. God, ontological arguments for. Better yet, practical arguments against. There is no such listing. It would have helped a lot if it had come in time. Arguments against being foolish. Ontological and empirical, ancient and modern. See common sense. The trouble with being educated is that it takes a long time. It uses up the better part of your life, and when you are finished, what you know is that you would have benefited more by going into banking. I wonder if bankers ask such questions. They ask what the prime rate is up to today. If a banker goes out on the Dead Sea Desert, he probably takes a flare pistol and canteens and sea rations and a knife, not a crucifix displaying a previous idiocy that was intended to remind him. Destroyer of the people on the East Shore Freeway, and my hopes besides. Sri Krishna, you got us all. Good luck in your other endeavors, insofar as they are equally commendable in the eyes of other gods. I am faking it, I thought. These passions are bilge. I have become inbred from hanging around the Bay Area intellectual community. I think as I talk, pompously and in riddles. I am not a person, but a self-admonishing voice. Worse, I talk as I hear. Garbage in, as the computer science majors say, garbage out. I should stand up and ask Mr. Barefoot a meaningless question and then go home while he is phrasing the perfect answer. That way he wins and I get to leave. We both gain. He does not know me. I do not know him, except as a sententious voice. It ricochets in my head, I thought, already, and it's just begun. This is the first lecture of many. Sententious twaddle. The name of the Archer family's black retainer in perhaps a TV sitcom. Sententious, you get your black ass in here, you hear me? What this droll little man is saying is important. He is discussing Sri Krishna and how men die. This is a topic that I, from personal experience, deem significant. I should know because it is familiar to me. It showed up in my life years ago and will not go away. Once we owned a little old farmhouse. The wiring shorted out when someone plugged in a toaster. During rainy weather, water dripped from the light bulb in the kitchen ceiling. Jeff every now and then poured a coffee can of black tar-like stuff onto the roof to stop it from leaking. We could not afford the 90-weight paper. The tar did no good. Our house belonged with others like it in the flat part of Berkeley on San Pablo Avenue, near Dwight Way. The good part was that Jeff and I could walk to the Bad Luck restaurant and look at Fred Hill, the KGB agent, some said, who fixed the salads and owned the place and decided whose pictures got hung up for free exhibition. When Fred came to town years ago, all the party members in the Bay Area froze solid, out of fear. This was the tip-off that a Soviet hatchet man was in the vicinity. It also told you who belonged to the party and who did not. Fear reigned among the dedicated, but no one else cared. It was like the eschatological judge sorting the sheep, the faithful, from among the ordinary others, except in this case it was the sheep who quaked. Dreams of poverty excited universal enjoyment in Berkeley, coupled with the hope that the political and economic situation would worsen, throwing the country into ruin. This was the theory of the activists. Misfortune so vast that it would wreck everyone, responsible and not responsible alike, sinking into defeat. We were then, and we are now, totally crazy. It's literate to be crazy. For example, you would have to be crazy to name your daughter Goneril, like they taught us at the English department at Cal. Madness was funny to the patrons of the Globe Theater. It is not funny now. At home, you are a great artist, but here you are just the author of a difficult book about Here Comes Everybody. Big deal, I thought, with a drawing in the margin of someone thumbing his nose. And for that, like this speech now, we paid good money. You'd think having been poor so long would have taught me better, sharpened my wits, as it were, my instinct for self-preservation. I am the last living person who knew Bishop Timothy Archer of the Diocese of California, his mistress, his son, my husband, the homeowner and wage earner pro forma. Somebody should. Well, it would be nice if no one went the way they collectively went, volunteering to die, each of them, like Parsifal, a perfect fool. 2. Dear Jane Marion, within a period of 2 days, two people, one an editor friend, the other a writer friend, recommended The Green Cover to me, both of them saying the same thing, in effect, that if I wanted to know what was happening in contemporary literature, I had goddamn well better know your work. When I got the book home, I had been told that the titular essay was the best and to start with it. I realized that you had herein done a piece on Tim Archer, so I read that. All of a sudden, he was alive again, my friend. It brings fierce pain to me, not joy. I can't write about him, since I'm not a writer, although I did major in English at Cal. Anyhow, one day, as a sort of exercise, I sat down and scratched out a spurious dialogue between him and me to see if I could by any chance recapture the cadence of his endless flow of talk. I found I could do it, but like Tim himself, it was dead. People ask me sometimes what he was like, but I'm not into Christianity, so I don't encounter church people that often, although I used to. My husband was his son, Jeff, so I knew Tim on a rather personal basis. Frequently, we talked theology. At the time of Jeff's suicide, I met Tim and Kirsten at the airport in San Francisco. They were briefly back from England and meeting with the official translators of the Zadokite documents, at which point in his life Tim first began to believe that Christ was a fraud and that the Zadokite sect possessed the true religion. He asked me how he should go about conveying this news to his flock. This was before Santa Barbara. He kept Kirsten in a plain apartment in the Tenderloin district of the city. Very few people went there. Jeff and I, of course, could. I remember when Jeff first introduced me to his father. Tim walked up to me and said, "My name's Tim Archer." He didn't mention he was a bishop. He did have on the ring, though. I'm the one who got the phone call about Kirsten's suicide. We were still suffering over Jeff's suicide. I had to stand there and listen to Tim telling me that Kirsten had just slipped away. I could see my little brother, who had really been fond of Kirsten. He was assembling a balsa wood model of a Spad 13. He knew the call was from Tim, but of course he didn't know that now Kirsten, along with Jeff, was dead. Tim differed from everyone else I ever knew in these respects. He could believe in anything, and he would immediately act on the basis of his new belief. That is, until he ran into another belief, and then he acted on that. He was convinced, for example, that a medium had cured Kirsten's son's mental problems, which were severe. One day, watching Tim on TV being interviewed by David Frost, I realized that he was talking about me and Jeff. However, there was no real relationship between what he was saying and the reality situation. Jeff was watching, too. He did not know that his father was talking about him. Like the medieval realists, Tim believed that words were actual things. If you could put it into words, it was de facto true. This is what cost him his life. I wasn't in Israel when he died, but I can visualize him out on the desert studying the map the way he looked at a gas station map in downtown San Francisco. The map said that if you drove X miles, you would arrive at place Y, whereupon he would start up the car and drive X miles, knowing that Y would be there. It said so on the map. The man who doubted every article of Christian doctrine believed everything he saw written down. But the incident that for me conveyed the most about him took place in Berkeley one day. Jeff and I were supposed to meet Tim at a particular corner at a particular time. Tim drove up late. Running after him came a gas station attendant, furiously angry. Tim had filled up at this man's station and then backed over a pump, mashing it flat, whereupon Tim had driven off because he was late for his appointment with us. "You destroyed my pump!" the attendant yelled, totally out of breath and totally beside himself. "I can call the police! You just drove off! I had to run all the way after you!" What I wanted to see was whether Tim would tell this man, a very angry but really a very modest man in the social order, a man at the bottom of the scale on which Tim really stood at the top, I wanted to see if Tim would inform him that he was the bishop of the Diocese of California and was known all over the world, a friend of Martin Luther King, Jr., a friend of Robert Kennedy, a great and famous man who wasn't at the moment wearing his clericals. Tim did not. He humbly apologized. It became evident to the gas station attendant after a bit that he was dealing with someone for whom large, brightly colored metal pumps did not exist. He was dealing with a man who was, quite literally, living in another world. That other world was what Tim and Kirsten called the other side. And step by step, that other side drew them all to it. First Jeff, then Kirsten, and, ineluctably, Tim himself. Sometimes I tell myself that Tim still exists, but totally now in that other world. How does Don McLean put it in his song, Vincent? This world was never meant for one as beautiful as you. That's my friend. This world was never really real to him, so I guess it wasn't the right world for him. A mistake got made somewhere, and underneath he knew it. When I think about Tim, I think, and still I dream he treads the lawn, walking ghostly in the dew, pierced by my glad singing through, as Yeats put it. Thank you for your piece on Tim, but it hurt to find him alive again for a moment. I guess that is the measure of greatness in a piece of writing, that it can do that. I believe it was in one of Aldous Huxley's novels that a character phones up another character and exclaims excitedly, "I've just found a mathematical proof for the existence of God." Had it been Tim, he would have found another proof the next day, contravening the first, and would have believed that just as readily. It was as if he was in a garden of flowers, and each flower was new and different, and he discovered each in turn and was equally delighted by each, but then forgot the ones that came before. He was totally loyal to his friends. Those he never forgot. Those were his permanent flowers. The strange part, Miss Marion, is that in a way I miss him more than I miss my husband. Maybe he made more of an impression on me. I don't know. Perhaps you can tell me. You're the writer. Cordially, Angel Archer. I wrote that to the famous New York literary establishment author Jane Marion, whose essays appear in the best of the little magazines. I did not expect an answer, and I got none. Maybe her publisher, to whom I sent it, read it and flipped it away. I don't know. Marion's essay on Tim had infuriated me. It was based entirely on second-hand information. Marion never knew Tim, but she wrote about him anyhow. She said something about Tim giving up friendships when it served his purpose, or something like that. Tim never gave up a friendship in his life. That appointment that Jeff and I had made with the bishop was an important one, in two respects, official and, as it turned out, unofficial. Regarding the official aspect, I proposed and intended to carry off a meeting, a merger, between Bishop Archer and my friend Kirsten Lundborg, who represented FEM in the Bay Area. The female emancipation movement wanted Tim to make a speech on its behalf, a speech for free. As the wife of the bishop's son, it was thought I could pull it off. Needless to say, Tim did not seem to understand the situation, but that was not his fault. Neither Jeff nor I had clued him in. Tim supposed we were getting together to have a meal at the Bad Luck, which he had heard about. Tim would be paying for the meal because we didn't have any money at all that year, or for that matter, the year before. As a clerical typist in a law office on Shattuck Avenue, I was the putative wage earner. The law office consisted of two Berkeley guys active in all the protest movements. They defended in cases involving drugs. Their firm was called Barnes & Gleason Law Office and Candle Shop. They sold handmade candles, or at least displayed them. It was Jerry Barnes' way of insulting his own profession and making it clear that he had no intention of bringing in any money. Regarding this goal, he was successful. I remember one time a grateful client paid him in opium, a black stick that looked like a bar of unsweetened chocolate. Jerry was at a loss as to what to do with it. He wound up giving it away. It was interesting to watch Fred Hill, the KGB agent, greeting all his customers the way a good restaurateur does, shaking hands and smiling. Hill had cold eyes. According to the talk on the street, he had the authority to murder those under party discipline who seemed restive. Tim paid hardly any attention to Fred Hill as the son of a bitch led us to a table. I wondered what the Bishop of California would say if he knew that the man handing us our menus was a Russian national, here in the U.S. under a fake name, an officer in the Soviet secret police. Or perhaps this was all a Berkeley myth. As in the many preceding years, Berkeley and paranoia were bedfellows. The end of the Vietnam War was a long way off. Nixon had yet to pull out U.S. forces. Watergate still lay several years ahead. Government agents rooted about the Bay Area. We independent activists suspected everyone of conniving. We trusted neither the right nor the CPUSA. If there was any single hated thing in Berkeley, it was the smell of the police. "Hello, folks," Fred Hill said. "The soup today is minestrone. Would you like a glass of wine while you decide?" The three of us said we wanted wine, just so long as it wasn't Gallo, and Fred Hill went off to get it. "He's a colonel in the KGB," Jeff said to the bishop. "Very interesting," Tim said, scrutinizing the menu. "They're really underpaid," I said. "That would be why he has opened up a restaurant," Tim said, looking around him at the other tables and patrons. "I wonder if they have Black Sea caviar here." Glancing up at me, he said, "Do you like caviar, Angel?" "The roe of the sturgeon, although they do sometimes pass off the roe of Cyclopterus lumpus as caviar. However, that is generally of a reddish hue and larger. It is much cheaper. I don't care for it. Lumpfish caviar, I mean. In a sense, to say lumpfish caviar is an oxymoron." He laughed, mostly to himself. "Shit," I thought. "What's wrong?" Jeff said. "I'm just wondering where Kirsten is," I said. I looked at my watch. The bishop said, "The origins of the feminist movement can be found in Lysistrata. We must refrain from all touch of baubled love." Again he laughed. "With bolts and bars our orders flout, and..." He paused as if considering whether to go on. "And shut us out." It's a pun. "Shut us out" refers both to the general situation of non-compliance and a shutting up of the vagina. "Dad," Jeff said, "we're trying to figure out what to order, okay?" The bishop said, "If you mean we're trying to decide what to have to eat, my remark is certainly applicable. Aristophanes would have appreciated that." "Come on," Jeff said. Carrying a tray, Fred Hill returned. "Louis Martini Burgundy." He set down three glasses. "If you'll excuse my asking, aren't you Bishop Archer?" The bishop nodded. "You marched with Dr. King at Selma," Hill said. "Yes, I was at Selma," the bishop said. I said, "Tell him your vagina joke." To Fred Hill, I said, "The bishop knows a real old vagina joke." Chuckling, Bishop Archer said, "The joke is old, she means. Don't misunderstand syntactically." Dr. King was a great man, Fred Hill said. He was a very great man, the bishop said. I'll have the sweetbreads. That's a good choice, Fred Hill said, jotting. Also, let me recommend the pheasant.
I'll have the veal Oscar, I said.
So will I, Jeff said.
He seemed moody.
I knew that he objected to my using my friendship with the bishop in order to get a free speech for FEM or any other group. He knew how easily free speeches got tugged out of his father. Both he and the bishop wore dark wool business suits, and of course Fred Hill, famous KGB agent and mass killer, wore a suit and tie. I wondered that day, sitting there with the two of them in their business suits, if Jeff would go into holy orders as his father had. Both men looked solemn, bringing to the task of ordering dinner the same intensity, the same gravity, that they brought to so much else. The professional stance oddly punctuated on the bishop's part with wit, although, like today, the wit never struck me as quite right. As we spooned up our minestrone soup, Bishop Archer talked about his forthcoming heresy trial. It was a subject he found endlessly fascinating. Certain Bible Belt bishops were out to get him because he had said in several published articles and in his sermons preached at Grace Cathedral that no one had seen hide nor hair of the Holy Ghost since apostolic times. This had caused Tim to conclude that the doctrine of the Trinity was incorrect. If the Holy Ghost was, in fact, a form of God equal to Yahweh and Christ, surely he would still be with us. Speaking in tongues did not impress him. He had seen a lot of it in his years in the Episcopal Church, and it struck him as autosuggestion and dementia. Further, a scrupulous reading of Acts disclosed that at Pentecost, when the Holy Ghost descended on the disciples, giving them the gift of speech, they had spoken in foreign languages which people nearby had understood. This is not glossolalia, as the term is now used. This is xenoglossy. The bishop, as we ate, chortled over Peter's deft response to the charge that the 11 were drunk. Peter had said in a loud voice to the scoffing crowd that it was not likely that the 11 were drunk, inasmuch as it was only 9 a.m. The bishop pondered out loud, between spoonfuls of minestrone soup, that the course of Western history might have been changed if the time had been 9 p.m. instead of 9 a.m. Jeff looked bored, and I kept consulting my watch, wondering what was keeping Kirsten. Probably she had gone in to have her hair done. She fussed forever with her blonde hair, especially in anticipation of momentous occasions. The Episcopal Church is Trinitarian. You cannot be a priest or bishop of that church if you do not absolutely accept and teach that, well, it's called the Nicene Creed. And I believe in the Holy Ghost, the Lord and giver of life, who proceedeth from the Father and the Son, who with the Father and the Son together is worshipped and glorified. So Bishop McCleary back in Missouri was correct. Tim had, in fact, committed heresy. However, Tim had been a practicing lawyer before he became a rector of the Episcopal Church. He relished the oncoming heresy trial. Bishop McCleary knew his Bible, and he knew canon law, but Tim would blow golden smoke rings around him until McCleary would not know up from down. Tim knew this. In facing a heresy trial, he was in his element. Moreover, he was writing a book about it. He would win, and in addition, he would make some money. Every newspaper in America had carried articles and even editorials on the subject. Successfully trying someone for heresy in the 1970s was really difficult. Listening to Tim dilate endlessly, the thought came to me that he had calculatedly committed heresy in order to bring on the trial. At least he had done it unconsciously. It was, as the term has it, a good career move. The so-called gift of speech, the bishop said cheerfully, reverses the unity of language lost when the Tower of Babel was attempted. That is, its construction was attempted. When the day comes that someone in my congregation gets up and talks Walloon, well, that day I will believe that the Holy Ghost exists. I'm not sure he ever existed. The apostolic conception of the Holy Spirit is based on the Hebrew Ruach, the Spirit of God. For one thing, this spirit is female, not male. She speaks concerning the messianic expectation. Christianity appropriated the notion from Judaism, and when Christianity had converted a sufficient number of pagans, Gentiles, if you will, it abandoned the concept, since it was only meaningful to the Jews anyhow. To the Greek converts, it made no sense whatsoever, although Socrates declared that he had an inner voice or demon that guided him, a tutelary spirit, not to be confused with the English word demon, which of course refers to an indubitably evil spirit. The two terms are often confused. Do I have time for a cocktail?
They just have beer and wine here, I said.
I'd like to make a phone call, the bishop said. He dabbed at his chin with his napkin, rising to his feet and glancing about.
Is there a public phone?
There's a phone at the Chevron station, Jeff said, but if you go back there, you'll trash another pump.
I simply do not understand how that happened, the bishop said.
I never felt anything or saw anything. The first I knew was when Albers, I have his name written down, when he showed up in hysteria. Perhaps that was a manifestation of the Holy Ghost. I hope my insurance hasn't lapsed. It's always a good idea to carry automobile insurance.
I said, that wasn't Walloon he was speaking.
Yes, well, Tim said, it also wasn't intelligible. It may well have been glossolalia, for all I know. Maybe there is evidence that the Holy Ghost is here.
He reseated himself. Are we waiting for something? He asked me.
You keep looking at your watch. I only have an hour, then I have to get back to the city. The difficulty the dogma presents is that it strickens the creative spirit in man. Whitehead, Alfred North Whitehead, has given us the idea of God in process, and he is, or was, a major scientist. Process theology. It all goes back to Jakob Behme and his no-yes deity, his dialectic deity anticipating Hegel. Behme based that on Augustine. Sic et non, you know. Latin lacks a precise word for yes. I suppose sic is the closest, although by and large, sic is more correctly rendered as so, or hence, or in that manner. Quod si hoc nunc sic incipiam, nihil est. Quod si sic, tantundum egero. Et sic, he paused, frowning, nihil est. In a distributive language, English is the best example, that would literally mean nothing exists. Of course, what Terence means is, it is nothing, with it or it understood. Still, there is an enormous thrust in the two-word utterance nihil est, the amazing power of Latin to compress meaning into the fewest possible words. That and precision are the two most admirable qualities of it by far. English, however, has the greater vocabulary.
Dad, Jeff said, we're waiting for a friend of Angel's. I told you about her the other day.
Non video, the bishop said. I'm saying that I don't see her, the her being understood. Look, that man is going to take a picture of us. Fred Hill, carrying an SLR camera with flash attachment, approached our table. Your Grace, would it be all right with you if I took your picture?
Let me take a picture of you two together, I said, standing up. You can put it on the wall, I said to Fred Hill.
That would be fine with me, Tim said.
During the meal, Kirsten Lundborg joined us. She looked unhappy and fatigued, and she could find nothing on the menu that pleased her. She wound up drinking a glass of white wine, eating nothing, saying very little, but smoking one cigarette after another. Her face showed lines of strain. We did not know it then, but she had mild and chronic peritonitis, which can be, and was very soon for her, very serious. She hardly seemed aware of us. I assumed she had gone into one of her periodic depressions. I had no idea that day that she was physically ill.
You could probably get toast and a soft-boiled egg, Jeff said.
No. Kirsten shook her head. My body is trying to die, she said presently. She did not elaborate. We all felt uncomfortable. I suppose that was the idea in her mind. Perhaps not. Bishop Archer gazed at her attentively and with a great deal of sympathy. I wondered if he intended to suggest a laying on of hands. They do that in the Episcopal Church. The recovery rate due to that is not recorded anywhere that I know of, which is just as well. She spoke mostly about her son, Bill, who had been turned down by the army for psychological reasons. This seemed both to please her and to annoy her. I'm surprised to learn you have a son old enough to be inducted, the bishop said. For a moment, Kirsten was silent. Some of the worry that marred her features eased. It was evident to me that Tim's remark cheered her. At this point in her life, she was a rather good-looking woman, but a perpetual severity marred her in terms of her looks and in terms of the emotional impression that she presented. As much as I admired her, I knew that Kirsten could never turn down the chance to offer up a cruel remark, a defect that she had, in fact, honed into a talent. The idea seems to be that if you are clever enough, you can insult people and they will sit still for it. But if you are clumsy and dumb, you can get away with nothing. It all has to do with your verbal skills. You are judged, like contest entries, on aptness of phrase. Bill is only physically that old, Kirsten said. But she looked happier now. What is it that comic said the other night on Johnny Carson? My wife doesn't go to a plastic surgeon. She wants the real thing. I just had my hair done. That's why I was late. One time, just before I had to fly over to France, they did my hair so that... She smiled. I looked like Bozo the Clown. The whole time I was in Paris, I wore a babushka. I told everyone I was on my way to Notre Dame. What's a babushka? Jeff asked. Bishop Archer said, A Russian peasant. Regarding him intently, Kirsten said, That's true. I must have the wrong word. You have the right word, the bishop said. The term for the cloth worn about the head derives... Aw, Christ, Jeff said. Kirsten smiled. She sipped her white wine. I understand you're a member of FEM, the bishop said.
I am FEM, Kirsten said.
She's one of the founders, I said.
You know, I have very strong views about abortion, the bishop said.
You know, Kirsten said, I have too. What are yours?
We feel that the unborn have rights invested in them, not by man, but by Almighty God, the bishop said. The right to take a human life is denied, back to the Decalogue.
Let me ask you this, Kirsten said. Do you think a human being has rights after he or she is dead?
I beg your pardon, the bishop said.
Well, Kirsten said, you're granting them rights before they're born. Why not grant them equal rights after they're dead?
As a matter of fact, they do have rights after they're dead, Jeff said. You need a court order to use a cadaver or organs taken from a cadaver for...
I'm trying to eat this veal Oscar, I interrupted, seeing an endless line of argumentation ahead. And emerging from it, Bishop Archer's refusal to make a free speech for FEM. Can we talk about something else?
Fazed not at all, Jeff continued.
I know a guy who works for the coroner's office. He told me one time they went into the intensive care ward at, well, I forget which hospital. Anyhow, this woman had just died, and they went in and ripped her eyes out for a transplant before the monitors had stopped registering vital signs. He said it happens all the time.
We sat for a time, Kirsten sipping her wine, the rest of us eating. However, Bishop Archer had not stopped gazing at Kirsten with sympathy and concern. It came to me later, but not at the time, that he sensed that she was latently physically ill, sensed what the rest of us had missed. Perhaps it emanated from his pastoral ministering, but I saw him do this again and again, discern a need in someone when no one else, sometimes even the person involved, recognized it, or if they recognized it, took time to pause and care.
I have the highest regard for FEM, he said in a gentle voice.
Most people do, Kirsten said, but now she seemed genuinely pleased. Does the Episcopal Church allow the ordination of women?
For the priesthood, the bishop said. It hasn't come yet, but it is coming.
Then I take it you personally approve.
Certainly. He nodded.
I have taken an active interest in modernizing the standards for male and female deacons. For one, I will not allow the term deaconess to be used in my diocese. I insist that both male and female deacons be referred to as deacons. The standardization of educational and training bases for male and female deacons will make it possible later on to ordain female deacons to the priesthood. I see this as inevitable, and I am working actively for it.
Well, I am really pleased to hear you say this, Kirsten said. Then you differ markedly from the Catholic Church.
She set down her wine glass.
The Pope.
The Bishop of Rome, Bishop Archer said. That is what he actually is, the Bishop of Rome, the Roman Catholic Church. Our church is a Catholic church as well.
They won't ever ordain women, you think?
Kirsten said.
Only when the Parousia is here, Bishop Archer said.
What is that? Kirsten said. You'll have to excuse my ignorance. I really have no religious background or inclinations.
Neither do I, Bishop Archer said. I only know that, as Malebranche said, it is not I who breathes, but God who breathes in me. The Parousia is the presence of Christ. The Catholic Church, of which we are a part, breathes and breathes only through the living power of Christ. He is the head of which we are the body. Now the Church is his body. He is the head, as Paul said. It is a concept known to the ancient world and one we can understand.
Interesting, Kirsten said.
No, it is true, the bishop said. Intellectual matters are interesting, and so are odd factual things, such as the amount of salt produced by a single mine. This that I speak of is a topic that determines not what we know, but what we are. We have our life through Jesus Christ. He is the image of the unseen God and the firstborn of all creation, for in him were created all things in heaven and on earth, everything visible and everything invisible, thrones, dominations, sovereignties, powers. All things were created through him and for him. Before anything was created, he existed, and he holds all things in unity. The bishop's voice was low and intense. He spoke evenly, and as he spoke, he gazed directly at Kirsten, and I saw her return his gaze in almost a stricken way, as if she both wanted to hear and did not want to hear, fearing and fascinated. Many times I had heard Tim preach at Grace Cathedral, and he now addressed her, one person, with the same intensity that he brought to bear on great masses of people, and yet it was all for her. There was silence for a moment. A lot of the priests still say deaconess, Jeff said. He shuffled awkwardly. When Tim isn't around. I said to Kirsten, Bishop Archer is probably the strongest supporter of women's rights in the Episcopal Church. Actually, I think I've heard that, Kirsten said. She turned to me and said calmly, I wonder, do you suppose... I'd be glad to address your organization, the bishop said. That's why we're having lunch.
Reaching into his coat pocket, he brought out his black notebook.
I'll take your phone number, and I promise to call you within the next few days. I'll have to consult with Jonathan Graves, the bishop suffragan, but I'm sure I'll be able to find time for you.
I'll give you both my number at FEM, Kirsten said, and my home phone number. Do... She hesitated. Do you want me to tell you something about FEM, Bishop?
Tim, Bishop Archer said.
We are not militant in the conventional sense of...
I'm quite familiar with your organization, Bishop Archer said. I want you to consider this. If I have all the eloquence of men or of angels, but speak without love, I am simply a gong booming or a cymbal clashing. If I have the gift of prophecy, understanding all the mysteries there are, and knowing everything, and if I have faith in all its fullness, to move mountains, but without love, then I am nothing at all. 1 Corinthians chapter 13. As women, you find your place in the world out of love, not animosity. Love is not limited to the Christian. Love is not just for the church. If you wish to conquer us, show us love and not scorn. Faith moves mountains. Love moves human hearts. The people opposing you are people, not things. Your enemy is not men, but ignorant men. Don't confuse the men with their ignorance. It has taken years. It will take years more. Don't be impatient and don't hate. What time is it? He looked around, suddenly concerned. Here. He passed a card to Kirsten. You call me. I have to be going. It was nice meeting you. He left us then. I realized after he had gone, very suddenly realized, that he had forgotten to pay the check. 3. The Bishop of California spoke to the members of FEM and then talked their governing board out of $2,000 as a contribution to the church's fund for world famine, really a nominal sum and for a meritorious cause. It took a while for the news that Tim was seeing Kirsten socially to percolate down to Jeff and me. Jeff was simply amazed. I thought it was funny. It did not even strike Jeff as funny that his father had shaken $2,000 loose from FEM. He had seen a free speech looming up. That hadn't come to pass. He had anticipated friction and dislike between his father and my friend Kirsten. That had not come to pass either. Jeff did not understand his own father. The way I found out was through Kirsten, not Tim. I got a phone call the week following Tim's speech. Kirsten wanted to go shopping with me in San Francisco. When you're dating a bishop, you do not tell everybody in town. Kirsten spent hours fussing with dresses and blouses and tops and skirts at store after store before even hinting at what was going on. My promised silence was secured in advance by means of oaths more elaborate than those of the Rosicrucians. Telling me was 10% of the fun. She strung the revelation out, seemingly forever. We were, in fact, all the way down at the marina before I fathomed what she had been hinting at. "If Jonathan Graves finds out," Kirsten said, "Tim will have to resign." I could not even remember who Jonathan Graves was. The disclosure seemed irreal. I thought at first that she was joking, and then I thought she was hallucinating. "The Chronicle would put it on page one," Kirsten said, in a solemn tone, "and on top of the heresy trial." "Jesus Christ," I said, "you can't sleep with a bishop." "I already have," Kirsten said. "Who else have you told?" "Nobody else. I'm not sure if you should tell Jeff. Tim and I talked it over. We couldn't decide." "We," I thought. "You destructive bitch," I thought. "To get laid, you'd ruin a man's entire life. A man who knew Dr. King and Bobby Kennedy and determines the opinion of... my opinion, to name one person." "Don't look so upset," Kirsten said. "Whose idea was it?" "Why should it make you angry? Was it your idea?" Kirsten said calmly, "We discussed it." After a minute, I began to laugh. Kirsten, annoyed at first, presently joined me. We stood on the grass by the edge of the bay, laughing and holding on to each other. Passing people regarded us with curiosity. "Was it any good?" I managed to say finally. "I mean, what was it like?" "It was terrific. But now he has to confess." "Does that mean you can't do it again?" "It just means he has to confess again." "Aren't you going to go to hell?" Kirsten said, "He is, I'm not." "Doesn't that bother you? That I'm not going to hell?" She giggled. "We have to be real adult about this," I said. "Yes, we do. We absolutely have to be totally adult. We have to walk around as if everything is normal. This is not normal. I mean, it isn't like I'm saying it's abnormal in the sense of, you know, like making it with a goat." Kirsten said, "I wonder if there's a word for it, making it with an Episcopal bishop. Bishopric. Tim told me that word." "Bishopric?" "No, bishopric. You're not pronouncing it right." We had to hold on to each other to keep from falling. Neither of us could stop laughing. "It's the place he lives or something." "Oh, God." She wiped the tears of laughter from her eyes. "Always be sure you pronounce it bishopric. This is terrible. We really are going to go to hell. Straight to hell. You know what he let me do?" Kirsten leaned close to me to whisper in my ear. "I tried on some of his robes and his mitre. You know, the shovel hat? The first lady bishop." "You may not be the first." "I looked great. I looked better than he does. I want you to see. We're getting an apartment. For Christ's sake, don't say anything about this part especially, but he's paying for it out of his discretionary fund." "Church money?" I stared at her. "Listen." Kirsten looked solemn again, but she could not maintain her expression. She hid her face in her hands. "Isn't that illegal?" I said. "No, it's not illegal. That's why it's called the bishop's discretionary fund. He gets to do with it what he wants. I'm going to go to work for him as, we haven't decided, but some kind of general secretary, like a booking agent or something, to handle all the speeches and traveling he does, his business affairs. I can still stay on with the organization. FEM, I mean." She was silent a moment, and then she said,
The problem is going to be Bill. I can't tell him because he's nuts again. I shouldn't say that. Deep autistic pupil withdrawal, with impaired ideation compounded with delusions of reference, plus alternating catatonic stupor and excitement. He's down at Hoover Pavilion at Stanford, mostly for diagnosis. In terms of diagnosis, they're the best on the West Coast. They use something like 4 psychiatrists for diagnosis, 3 from the hospital itself and 1 from outside. I'm sorry, I said. The Army thing did it. Anxiety about being drafted. They accused him of malingering. Well, I guess it's part of life. He had to drop out of school anyhow. He would have had to drop school anyhow, is what I'm trying to say. His episodes always begin the same way. He starts crying, and he doesn't take out the trash. The crying part doesn't bother me. It's the goddamn trash. It just piles up, trash and garbage. And he doesn't bathe, and he stays in his apartment. And he doesn't pay his utility bills, so they cut off his gas and electricity. And he starts writing letters to the White House. This is one area Tim and I haven't discussed. I really don't discuss it with very many people. So I would estimate that I can keep our affair, my affair with Tim, secret, because I've had practice keeping things secret. No, pardon me, it doesn't begin with him crying. It begins with him not being able to drive his car. Driving phobia. He's afraid he'll veer off the road. First it has to do with the East Shore Freeway, and then it spreads to all the other streets. And then he winds up afraid to walk to the store, so as a result he can't shop for food. But that doesn't matter, because by that time he isn't eating anything anyhow. She lapsed into silence. There's a Bach cantata about it, she said finally, and I saw her try to smile. A line in the coffee cantata, about having trouble with your children. There are 100,000 miseries, something like that. Bill used to play the goddamn thing. Few people know Bach wrote a cantata about coffee, but he did. We walked in silence. It sounds as if, I said, it's schizophrenia. They use him to try out every new phenothiazine that comes along. He goes in cycles, but the cycles get worse. He's sick longer, and he's more sick. I shouldn't have brought it up. It's not your problem. I don't mind. Kirsten said, maybe Tim can effect a deep spiritual cure. Didn't Jesus cure mentally ill people? He sent the evil spirits into a bunch of pigs, I said, and they all rushed off a cliff. That seems like a waste, Kirsten said. They may have eaten them anyhow. Not if they were Jews. Anyhow, who would want to eat a pork chop that had an evil spirit in it? I shouldn't joke about this, but I will talk to Tim about it, but not for a while. I think Bill got it from me. I'm screwed up, God knows. I'm screwed up, and I screwed him up. I keep looking at Jeff and noticing the difference between them. They're about the same age, and Jeff has such a good grip on reality. Don't bet on it, I said. Kirsten said, when Bill gets out of the hospital, I'd like him to meet Tim. I'd like him to meet your husband, in fact. They never have met, have they? No, I said. But if you think Jeff can serve as a role model, I'm really not... Bill has very few friends. He's not outgoing. I've talked about you and your husband. You're both his age. Thinking about it, I perceived down the pipe of time Kirsten's lunatic son messing up our lives. That thought surprised me. It was utterly devoid of charity, and it had in it an essence of fear. I knew my husband, and I knew myself. Neither of us was ready to take on the job of amateur therapy. Kirsten, however, was an organizer. She organized people into doing things. Good things, but things not necessarily to their own benefit. I had, at that instant, a keen intuition that I was being hustled. At the bad luck, I had essentially witnessed Bishop Archer and Kirsten Lundborg hustle each other in an intricate transaction, but it was apparently a transaction that benefited them both, or anyhow, they both thought so. This, with her son Bill, looked to me like a purely one-way matter. I didn't see what we had to gain. Let me know when he's out, I said. But I think that Tim, because of his professional training, would be a better... But there's the age difference, and you get the element of the father figure. Maybe that would be good. Maybe that's what your son needs. Glaring at me, Kirsten said, I've done an excellent job of raising Bill. His father walked out of our lives and never looked back.
I didn't mean...
I know what you meant.
Kirsten stared at me, and now, really, she had changed. She was angry, and I could see hatred on her face. It made her look older. It made her look, in fact, physically ill. She had a bloated quality, and I felt uncomfortable. I thought then of the pigs that Jesus had cast the evil spirits into, the pigs that rushed over the cliff. This is what you do when an evil spirit inhabits you, I thought. This is the sign, this look, the stigma. Maybe your son did inherit it from you. But now we had an altered situation. Now she was my father-in-law's pro tem lover, potentially his mistress. I couldn't tell Kirsten to go fuck herself. She was family, in an illegal and unethical way. I was stuck with her. All of the curses of family, I thought, and none of the blessings. And I arranged it. The idea of introducing her and Tim had been mine. Bad karma, I thought. Come back from the other side of the barn, as my father used to say. Standing there in the grass near the San Francisco Bay, in the mid-afternoon sunlight, I felt uncomfortable. This is really, in some respects, a reckless and savage person, I said to myself. She dabbles in the life of a famous and respected man. She has a psychotic son. Pins bristle from her as from an animal. Bishop Archer's future depends on Kirsten not flying into a rage one day and phoning up the Chronicle. His future depends on her unending goodwill. Let's go back to Berkeley, I said.
No,
Kirsten shook her head. I have yet to find a dress I can wear. I came to the city to shop. Clothes are very important to me. They have to be. I'm seen in public a lot, and I expect to be seen much more now that I'm with Tim.
Rage still showed on her face. I said, I'll go back by BART. I walked away.
She's a very attractive woman, Jeff said that night when I told him, considering her age.
Kirsten is on Reds, I said.
You don't know that.
I suspect it. Her mood changes. I've seen her take them. Yellow jackets, you know, barbiturates, sleeping pills.
Everybody takes something. You smoke grass.
I said, but I'm sane.
You may not be when you get to be her age. It's too bad about her son.
It's too bad about your father.
Tim can manage her.
He may have to have her killed.
Eyeing me, Jeff said, what a strange thing to say.
She's out of control. And what happens when Bounding Bill the Dingaling finds out?
I thought you said,
he'll be out. It costs thousands of dollars to be in Hoover Pavilion. You stay about 4 days. I've known people who passed in their front door and out the back. Even with all the financial resources of the Episcopal Diocese of California, Kirsten can't keep him in there. He'll bound out on kangaroo spring shoes one of these days, his eyes rolling around in their sockets. That's all Tim needs. First she has me introduce her to Tim, then she tells me about her son, the madman. Tim will be preaching a sermon some Sunday morning at Grace Cathedral, and all of a sudden this lunatic will stand up, and God will grant him the gift of tongues, and that'll be the end of the most famous bishop in America.
Life is a risk.
I said, that's probably what Dr. King said that last morning of his life. They're all dead but Tim, anyhow. Dr. King is dead, Bobby Kennedy and Jack Kennedy are dead. I've set up your father.
I knew it that evening as I sat with my husband in our little living room.
He stops bathing. He stops taking out the garbage. He writes letters. What more do you need to know? He's probably writing a letter to the Pope right now. Martians probably walked through the wall of his room and told him about his mother and your father.
Christ.
And I did it.
I reached around under the couch for my beer can of grass.
Don't get loaded. Please.
You worry about me, I thought, when madness rules our friends.
One joint, I said. Half a joint. I'll toke up. A puff. I'll look at the joint. I'll pretend to look at the joint.
I fished the empty beer can out. I guess I moved my stash, I said to myself, to a safer place. I remember, in the middle of the night, I decided that monsters were going to rip me off. Mad Margaret from Ruddigore enters. The picture of theatrical madness, or however Gilbert put it.
Maybe I smoked it all up, I said. And I don't remember, I thought, because that's what Mary Jane does to you, sucks up your short-term memory. Probably I smoked it up 5 minutes ago, and already I've forgotten. You're borrowing trouble, Jeff said. I like Kirsten. I think it'll work out. Tim misses my mother. Tim misses getting his rocks off, I said to myself. That is a truly kinky lady, I said. I had to come home by snail train. It took 2 hours. I'm going to talk to your father. No, you're not. I will. I'm responsible. My stash is behind the stereo tuner. I'm going to get totally wasted and phone Tim and tell him that... I hesitated, and then futility crushed me. I felt like crying. Seating myself, I got out a Kleenex. God damn it, I said. Fry the bacon is not a game bishops are supposed to play. If I had known he felt that way... Fry the bacon? Jeff said wonderingly. Pathology frightens me. I sense pathology. I sense highly professional, responsible people wrecking their lives in exchange for a warm body, a temporarily warm body. I don't even sense the bodies staying warm, for that matter. I sense everything getting cold. You're only supposed to get into such limited time-binding if you're on junk and think in hours. These people are supposed to think in terms of decades, lifetimes. They meet in a restaurant run by Fred the Hatchet Man, which is ill omen incarnate, the ghost of Berkeley coming back to get us all. And when they leave, they have each other's phone number, and it's all accomplished. What I wanted to do was help a woman's lib group. But then everyone queeged out on me, you included. You were there. You watched it happen. I watched it happen. I was as crazy as the rest of you. I suggested that Fred the Soviet narc get photographed with the Bishop of the Diocese of California. They should have been in drag, according to my logic. The trouble with seeing ruin coming is that... I wiped at my eyes. Please, God, let me locate my Mary Jane. Jeff, look behind the tuner. It's in a Carl's Jr. bag, a white bag, okay? Okay. Obligingly, Jeff rummaged behind the tuner. I found it. Calm down. You can see ruin, but you can't see what direction it's coming from. It just sort of hangs there like a cloud. Who was that character in Lil Abner who had the cloud following him around? You know, this was the stuff the FBI was trying to hang on Martin Luther King. Nixon loves this shit. Maybe Kirsten is a government agent. Maybe I am. Maybe we're programmed. Pardon me for playing Cassandra in our collective movie, but I see death. I thought Tim Archer, your father, was a spiritual person. Does he dive into... I broke off. My metaphor is offensive. Forget it. Does he go after women like this normally? I mean, is this just merely the fact that I know about it and arranged it? Remind me not to go to Mass. Not that I ever do. There's no telling where the hands that hold out the chalice... That's enough. No, I get to be crazy along with Bong Bong Bill and Creepy Kirsten and Tim the no longer torpid and Jeff the jerk, you jerk. Is there a joint already rolled, or do I have to chew up grass like a cow? I can't roll a joint right now. Look! I held out my hands. They shook. This is called a grand mal seizure. Get somebody in here. Get up to the avenue and score me some tranks. I will tell you what is coming. Somebody's life is going to get destroyed because of all this. Not this that I'm doing right now, but this that I did at the Bad Luck, appropriately named. When I die, I will have a choice, head up in shit or head down in shit. Shit is the word for it, what I did. I had begun to gasp, crying and gasping. I reached for the joint my husband held. Light it for me, I said, you fool. I really can't chew it up. It's a waste. You have to chew up half a lid to get off, or at least I do. God knows about the rest of the world. Maybe they can get off anyhow, any time. Head down in shit and never able to get loaded again. Exactly what I deserve. And if I could call it all back, if I knew any way to call it back, I would. I am cursed with total insight. I see, and... You want to go to Kaiser? The hospital? I stared at him. I mean, you're out of control. That's what total insight does for you. Thanks. I took the joint, which he had lit, and inhaled. At least now I could no longer talk. And pretty soon I would no longer know or think. or even remember. Put on sticky fingers, I said to myself. The Stones. Sister Morphine. Hearing about all those bloody sheets calms me. I wish there was a comforting hand placed on my head, I thought. I'm not the one who's going to be dead tomorrow, although I should be. Let us by all means name the most innocent person possible. That will be the one. The bitch made me walk home, from San Francisco.
You took... That's walking.
Jeff said, I like her. I think she's a good friend. I think she will be, and probably is already, good for Dad. Has it occurred to you that you're jealous?
What?
I said. That's right. I said jealous. You're jealous of the relationship. You wish you were part of it. I see your reaction as an insult to me. I should be... Our relationship should be enough for you. I'm going for a walk. Suit yourself. If you had eyes in the front of your head... Let me finish. I'll be calm. I'll say it calmly. Tim is not just a religious figure. He speaks for thousands in the church and outside the church, maybe more so outside. Do you grasp it? If he tumbles, we all take a fall. We all are doomed. He is almost the last one left. The others are dead. The thing about this is, it isn't necessary. It's like he decided. He saw it, and he walked right at it. He didn't duck, and he didn't fight. He embraced it. You think this, what I feel, is because I had to come home on the train? One by one, they got every public figure, and now Tim hands over the keys, hands them over under his own power, without a fight. And you want to fight. Me, if necessary. I said, I see you as stupid. I see everyone as dumb. I see stupidity winning. This is not something the Pentagon is doing. This is dumb. This is walking right at it and saying, take me, I'm... Jealousy, Jeff said. Your psychological motivation is all over this house. I have no psychological motivation. I just want to see someone there when the firing ends. Someone who isn't... I broke off. Don't come around later and say this was done to us, because it wasn't. And don't tell me it was a complete surprise. A bishop who has an affair with a woman he meets in a restaurant. This is a man who just finished backing over a gasoline pump and drove happily away. And the pump came after him. That's how it works. You flatten some joker's pump, and he runs until he catches up with you. You're in a car, and he's on foot, but he seeks you out. And then all of a sudden, there he is. This is that. This is someone chasing us down, and he will catch up. He always does. I saw that pump jockey. He was mad. He was going to keep running. They never give up. And you see that now, due to one of your best friends. That's the worst kind. Grinning, Jeff said, I know that story. It's a W.C. Fields story. There's this director. And she isn't running anymore, I said. She caught up with him. They're renting an apartment. All it takes is one nosy neighbor. What about this redneck bishop prosecuting Tim for heresy? What would he do with this? If someone is after you for heresy, do you bang the next broad you meet for lunch and then go shopping for an apartment? Look. I walked over to my husband. Where do you go after being a bishop? Is Tim tired of that already? He got tired of everything else he ever did. He even got tired of being an alcoholic. He's the only hopeless drunk who sobered himself up out of boredom, out of a short attention span. People generally will their own misfortune. I see us doing that now. I see him getting bored and subconsciously saying, what the hell, it's dull putting on these funny clothes every day. Let's stir up some human misery and see what comes out of it. Laughing, Jeff said, you know what, who, you remind me of, the witch in Purcell's Dido and Aeneas. What do you mean? Who, like dismal ravens crying, beat the windows of the dying. I'm sorry, but... You fool Berkeley intellectual, I said. What horse's ass world do you inhabit? Not the same as me, I hope. Quoting some old verse, that's what did us in, they will report when they dig up our bones. Your dad quoted the Bible in the restaurant the same way you're doing now. You ought to hit me, or me you. I'll be glad when civilization ends. People babble out bits of books. put on sticky fingers. Put on sister morphine. I can't be trusted with the stereo at this moment. You do it for me. Thanks for the joint. When you're calmed down...
When you've woken up, I said, it'll all be over.
Jeff bent to search for the record I wanted to hear. He said nothing. Finally, he had become angry. A dollar short and a day late, I thought, and at the wrong person, like with me. Destroyed by our giant intellects, reasoning and pondering and doing nothing. Nitwits rule. We squabble. The sorceress in Dido. You are right. Thy hand, Belinda, darkness shades me. On thy bosom let me rest. More I would, but death invades me. And what else does she say? Death is now a welcome guest. Shit, I thought. It is relevant. He's right. Absolutely right.
Fiddling with the stereo, Jeff put the Stones record on. The music calmed me, a little. But I still cried, thinking about Tim. And all because they are stupid. It goes no deeper than that. And that is the worst of it all, that it is that simple, that there is no more.
A few days later, after thinking about it and making up my mind, I phoned Grace Cathedral and got an appointment to see Tim. He met me in his office, which was large and beautiful, in a building separate from the cathedral itself. After greeting me with a hug and kiss, he showed me two ancient clay vessels, which he explained had been used as oil lamps in the Near East over 4,000 years ago. As I watched him handling them, the thought came to me that the lamps probably, in fact certainly, did not belong to him. They belonged to the diocese. I wondered what they were worth. It was amazing that they had survived all these years. "It's nice of you to give me some of your time," I said. "I know how busy you are." The expression on Tim's face told me that he knew why I had shown up in his office. He nodded absently, as if, in fact, giving me as little of his attention as he could manage. I had seen him tune out that way several times. A part of his brain listened, but the greater part had sealed itself off already. When I had finished delivering my set little speech, Tim said gravely, "Paul, you know, had been a Pharisee. For them, a strict observance of the minutiae of the Torah, the law, was everything. That particularly involved ritual purity. But later, after his conversion, he saw salvation not in the law, but in tzaddikah, which is the state of righteousness that Jesus Christ brings. I want you to sit down with me here." He beckoned me over, opening a very large leather-bound Bible. "You're familiar with Romans 4 through 8? "No, I'm not," I said. But I sat down beside him. I could see it coming, the lecture, the sermon. Tim had met me prepared.
Romans 5 states Paul's basic premise, that we are saved through grace and not by works. He read then from the Bible he held open on his lap. "So far, then, we have seen that through our Lord Jesus Christ, by faith we are judged righteous and at peace with God." He glanced up at me. His gaze was keen and sharp. This was Timothy Archer, the lawyer. "Since it is by faith and through Jesus that we have entered this state of grace in which we can boast about looking forward to God's glory. Let's see." He ran his fingers down the page, his lips moving. "If it is certain that through one man's fall so many died, it is even more certain that divine grace, coming through the one man, Jesus Christ, came to so many as an abundant free gift." He looked further on, turning pages. "Yes. Ah. Here. But now we are rid of the law, freed by death from our imprisonment, free to serve in the new spiritual way, and not the old way of a written law." Again he looked further along. "The reason, therefore, why those who are in Christ Jesus are not condemned is that the law of the Spirit of life in Christ Jesus has set you free from the law of sin and death." He glanced up at me. This goes to the heart of Paul's perception. What sin really refers to is hostility toward God. Literally, it means missing the mark. As if, for example, you shot an arrow and it fell short, too low, or went too high. What mankind needs, what it requires, is righteousness. Only God has that, and only God can provide it to men. Men and women, I don't mean. I understand, I said. Paul's perception is that faith, pistis, has the power, the absolute power, to kill sin. Out of this comes freedom from the law. One is not required to believe that by following a formal stipulated code, code ethics it's called, one is saved. That position, that one is saved by following a very intricate, complex system of code ethics, is what Paul rebelled against. That was the position of the Pharisees, and that's what he turned from. This really is what Christianity, faith in our Lord Jesus Christ, is all about. Righteousness through grace, and grace coming through faith. I'm going to have you read. Yes, I said, but the Bible says you're not supposed to commit adultery. Instantly, Tim said, adultery is sexual unfaithfulness on the part of a married person. I am no longer married. Kirsten is no longer married. Oh, I said, nodding. The seventh commandment, which pertains to the sanctity of marriage. End of side one. To continue, turn the cassette over.